Farm Radio with my dad, Farmer Brad, from the local food front in Washington County, Texas.
Jenny.
Well, today we had some good news.
We have rain.
That didn't sound very exciting.
Oh, we've got rain!
Yeah, over an inch. The first inch of rain that we've seen since late March. It's really been great.
It's been a nice steady rain. It's starting to look a little bit greener out there. I think we've had 3 days of some rain.
Light rain on Saturday, then it was perfect for our market day on Sunday, and then it's steady rain both Monday morning and Tuesday morning, so I think we have gotten close to a 2-inch
total.
Yeah,
we had a downpour, I think, the first day, whatever day that was, Saturday.
Well, that's exactly what we needed, is we're starting to get these beds ready in these fields, and I bought a new tool. We were dealing with some compaction down on this bottom field, our last bottom field that we're moving into, and we had it under a cover crop during the winter, but now is the first time we were working in our beds. It's going to be our fall and winter garden, and it's about 2 acres, but there was an obvious area you could see. I use a bottom buster, which is basically a plow that kind of pushes up soil on both sides of it. And if you can imagine one of them riding behind each tractor wheel, it's a double bottom buster, I guess. But it leaves you a 4-foot-wide raised bed between the tractor. You're riding over the tractor. And that's how we build our beds. And there was an obvious area. You can almost see a diagonal line going right across the field where this bottom buster wouldn't even dig in 2 inches, where normally it goes about 12 to 18 inches deep.
There was quite a bit of area that it wouldn't penetrate at all.
It was half the field.
Yeah.
And but on that half of that field, if you imagine a square, and on the northwest corner was a large galvanized steel water trough. So obviously, before we bought the place, cattle would hang out there and compacted the soil. Plus, there on that western side of that square is a very large tree line, you know, with up to 50-foot cottonwoods down in the creek where the creek enters our property.
So they were hiding from the sun.
Yeah, basically giving them afternoon shade. So it was interesting because it was just all on that half of the field, you know.
Right.
And so I ended up buying a new tool, a subsoiler, which worked well.
And that has one prong. That's how...
It's basically a, if you imagine one knife about 3 inches wide. I picked this one up at Tractor Supply. Didn't really take it serious when I first saw the thing, but I was desperate and I went out there. It was about $179.
How long is it?
Well, if you sink it all the way, it'll go about 18 inches deep. So it's varying as you go, so it's going about 12 to 18 inches deep. And I had to add some weight to it, about 160 pounds of weight to it to get it to dig in.
And you did this right before it started raining.
Yeah, we did it Friday.
Perfect timing.
So all Saturday and all during this rain, and I don't care how big that downpour was, we didn't have any water running off the farm because it was just sinking into these trenches, hungry, thirsty soil for water. But we noticed, you know, looking back, you know, this is going on our 4th year here at this farm, but the first 2 years we went through 2 extreme droughts or a 2-year-long drought, you know, divided by a flooding rain last year, floods, and this year a worse drought, or a longer period of no rain. It just started almost a month and a half earlier than the previous droughts. But you know, we don't really have any cracks anymore in our soil. I mean, we've obviously increased the organic matter and the biology soil and the water holding capacity.
There's
of the
a
soil.
Little bit, but it's definitely improved. There's not nearly the deep cracks that we had before.
Well, yeah, I mean, we didn't have any deep cracks in the paths of our beds because we wouldn't notice that when we were harvesting.
Yeah.
And the only place where there was noticeable large cracks were in the high traffic areas where our vehicles go through the farm to get to the fields, the tractor and the delivery van and the horse wagon. So, hey, I'm proud of my new tool. I think it worked. You know, now that we got enough moisture, we can go in there now and build these beds. It's perfect timing.
Yeah, the timing couldn't have been better. So
next time we have the show, I'm going to be talking about how we're already putting fall transplants.
So, Brad, Monday it was raining, and perfect timing because you had a scheduled talk with the Master Gardeners of Montgomery County. Yeah. And it turned out to be a great turnout.
Yeah, it doesn't disturb you so much being away from the farm when it's a full rainy day because, you know, you couldn't get any work done anyway. So that was, I felt good, you know, just traveling, knowing that, you know, there's always so much to do on the farm. But this was a group invited me out a few months ago, and I've talked to Master Gardeners before, and I really enjoy speaking with the group because these are basically the community leaders in their area teaching people how to grow, you know. And although they not be, you know, there's this dispute between organic and conventional because they are a part of the extension service, overall the big picture is that we have experienced people in the community that can mentor others and teach them how to grow. So we're all, they're playing a very important role. And when I, and typically because of their urban setting, they focus a lot on ornamental landscapes, but here we can expand the idea now and as an edible landscape and how local food can be grown. And I introduced them to what a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Program, was and how small farms can bring foods to their community, and they were fired up.
So all you master gardeners out there, be on watch, because Brad and I would love to start networking with you guys in order to move in that direction of y'all helping to teach people to grow their own food, at least some of it.
Well, with rising fuel prices and rising food prices, and especially we hear back from folks about how expensive just fruit is now because most of our fruit's imported. I don't really know. We don't buy much fruit, or we eat so much seasonally. I haven't, tell you the truth, I haven't noticed how high the food prices have gone up, but we've been hearing about it. And it's not affecting our prices in producing the food. But we'll talk about that with the John Eichert article.
Yes.
The interview, Small Farms or Real Farms.
Yes, one more thing, though. You talked on Tuesday.
I didn't talk. On Tuesday,
I'm sorry,
I went
didn't talk.
Out.
You attended the your brainchild from last year, the Farm and Food Leadership Training.
Yeah, Judith McGarry at the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance did an excellent job this year organizing the second annual Farm and Food Leaders Training Conference, and it's very empowering. There's about 100 folks that came out, and again, all grassroots leaders around the state. We talked about how to... you know, they talked about some issues on Monday, and the second day was focused on coalition building and just how we could all work together and speak the same language as we go out and try to communicate and promote local food and change and fresh food. But so
and
neat.
The challenges that the leader that people are facing in trying to raise food and you started this last year in...
Well, I started this last year because of the Farm Bill was going on, and I wanted to put something together that helped educate people on the issues pertaining to the Farm Bill. And we actually, when we put it, we were like, well, maybe this is something that we do every 2 years. But I'm so glad Judith did it this year, the second year. Judith McGarry and Bill Wenzel was back down from the Farmer to Farmer GMO Coalition, and Patty Levera, the Food and Water Watch, and Sustainable Food Center also co-sponsored it. Marla Camp with Edible Austin. And again, it's people all came together. And it was interesting because there were so many different leaders from different organizations that weren't even necessarily focused on food, but environmental groups, farm-to-school program groups.
But not only organizations. There were individual farmers.
Yeah,
and
people that are going to be active in the local food
revolution.
Anyone
who wants to take a leading role in this movement.
Well, it encouraged me, you know, because I've been kind of sitting back, focused on farming for the past 6 months or so since I left the TOFCA board. And it fired me up is, you know, just to be around, encouraged by those people and you know, and Bill Wenzel and them teasing me that they know I can't stand in the idle for very long. They know I'll be back.
Idle farming.
No, I'm not. You know what I'm talking about. Just in being active and promoting the issues and making that kind of an impact. So, again, just like speaking with the Master Gardeners who were their regional, local community leaders and growing, I had another day talking with, you know, community leaders over the whole state. And, man, it was a powerful 2 days.
Brad came home fired up both evenings, really excited. And it is energizing to be able to connect with others who are excited about what's going on and interested in being active and participating in what we're doing.
Well, yeah, it is encouraging, and y'all, everyone needs to go to it. you know, if you want to be actively involved in your community, this is a great place to network with others and learn more how to be effective. And I think if you go to the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance website,
FARFA,
if you go to their website, you can get an update about that conference. They're going to have DVDs and recorded it,
oh,
so
great.
People can miss. So
there was a panel on dairy issues, raw dairy, legal access to raw dairy is a big issue, and I think that was there was a panel on that.
Farm to school programs, the organic standards for the Texas Department of Agriculture. I mean, there's a lot of issues, you know, national animal ID system and all these things that concerns us and threatens our local food. So check out FARFA. Also, their website, they've got another website link, which is NAIS, N-A-I-S, NAISTruth.com.
For the National Animal Identification System problem.
Yeah, well, it goes to FARFA, so that's great. But Judith deserves a big hand, and I'm just, again, really happy and proud to be a part of these folks. And,
she has worked tirelessly.
We're going to get Judith on our show. I also want to get Bill Winslow and Patty LeVere and some of these other folks, get them on our show. So you'll hear about them in the future. But we've got a great interview coming up here now with John Eichert. And it's really, it's the best part of the last half is the best part of our interview because now we're starting to talk about why that small farms
are real farms.
So y'all enjoy it. This is Farmer Brad and Jenny, Home Sweet Farm Radio. We'll be back after talking with John Eichert.
Can support a family. Successful small farmers pursue a fundamentally different approach to farming than do big farmers. They reduce their reliance on purchased inputs by substituting labor and management for capital and purchased inputs. They are low-input farmers. They focus on creating value as well as reducing costs. They are niche marketers. They give individual consumers what they want rather than produce bulk commodities for mass markets. They do the things they do best, the things that they have a passion for, and as a consequence, do them better. They build relationships with their customers and thus are less vulnerable to the ups and downs of commodity prices. As a result of all these things, these small farmers can earn far greater income per dollar of sales than do conventional large farmers. A farm with $50,000 gross sales may well contribute $25,000 or more to support the family. A farm with gross sales of $100,000 can be a full-time family farm. This quote is from Small Farms Are Real Farms, Sustaining People Through Agriculture by John Eichert.
Time as president of TOFCA, I kept seeing a large proportion, seems like two groups of folks that were really wanting to get back into farming, and one of them was the baby boomers now that are ready to retire and have some money and buying their little ranchettes and their small places out here in the country, and yet they're wanting them to be productive, and these are folks that don't have any kind of agricultural background, but they have business background, and they know how to run a business. And then the second group of folks I was noticing were the young, some of the brightest graduates coming out of college that maybe still fantasizing about the farm life, but having an interest now in getting back into farming. And they are looking at it also from a business standpoint. And, you know, I bring up our story a little bit because I want it to always be an encouragement to folks. But, you know, I'm the first generation of my family returning to the farm after being off of it for three generations. And I think we're going to see more people returning to the farm like we never have before. And really the biggest hurdle, at least in this part of Texas, is just the price of land. And but somehow we need to connect these folks, these landowners, with the people that the young folks that have the energy and the enthusiasm that can still do it. And I'm encouraged. I think, like you said, opportunity is sky's the limit right now. The last couple years, local food has become more aware. You know, with normal food eaters are aware of local food now, right, like never before. And somehow, and I'm not concerned about food security or food shortages, because I'm looking out my window out here, and our rural landscapes, and I'm sure you see it driving through the country, are basically abandoned.
Right.
There's land sitting here idle, and and we're in the birthplace of Texas. This whole area of Texas was farmed at one time, growing food for folks, and being a new farmers getting into this, I think, have an advantage where they don't have a lot of baggage of the industrial paradigm in their mind. They're going at it a completely new approach, selling locally, coming up with CSA programs. Basically, our time of farming is based on relationships that we make with people in our community, and that's the ultimate accountability. And somehow, large metroplexes like Houston that you'll be coming here to in a few weeks, somehow I see metroplexes, these cities, need to reach out more to their country cousins. Because in order for Houston or any metroplex to be more sustainable in the future, they're going to have a healthy local food enterprise surrounding the city like it always used to be. So how can city cousins learn to reach out more to their country cousins, and for us to all realize that we're in on this together, you know?
Well, I think there are several things that have been done, and I certainly agree with the things that you're saying here. You know, a lot of people don't realize just how much, as you pointed out, I was glad you made the observation of how much unused land there is around, or very slightly used land that's out there today. And when people say, well, we can't continue to have an animal agriculture, I'm not going to argue that we, you know, we should have as much meat per capita in the future as we have today. I don't think I wouldn't say one way or the other, but when they argue that we can't have an animal agriculture without having this heavy animal feeding kind of agriculture, they're just ignoring the fact that there is just millions of acres of grasslands, rangelands, much of it that's unsuitable for crop production for human beings or for direct human consumption. That's just there idle or very, very lightly used as it is today. And we can have a lot of animals out there, which would make possible then a lot of organic kind of cropping farms that are mixed in with those animal operations where you're utilizing manure and creating a whole integrated cropping system. So I think that's an important thing in mind. Now, another important thing that you're getting at here is much of the best agricultural land in the country is very close to the major population centers in the country, because in large part the reason those population centers are where they are is that we, until, you know, the last few decades ago, about 50 years ago, we had pretty much a local-based food system. So you could only have a major metropolitan area in the proximity of a place where you can grow most of the fresh foods for the people that live there. You know, we've been moving cattle and meat across the country for a long time, but in general, the milk and the eggs and the vegetables and the produce, you know, we used to call it, all of that was produced pretty close to the city. So some of the best agricultural land in terms of crop production is located very close to the cities. And it is a major challenge then in terms of maintaining much of that land in farmlands and making it possible for farmers to gain access to that land, because that land nowadays is very high in price because of the development pressure and residential and business development pressure on it. But there are people that are, you know, that are doing various things, and, you know, some things work better some places than some another. One first thing that people generally think about is buying up the development rights on land, having agricultural zones where the people that have the right to develop that land close to the cities now, they sell off the development rights, and then the land can continue to be farmed. It's used more frequently for conservation. As much, I can't think of exactly the right name for it here, but selling it off and leaving the land as a green belt or conservation area, or, you know, a buffer zone along the creeks and that sort of thing. But the same thing can be used in terms of land trust, agricultural land trust, which are popular around the country. And if you can raise the money to buy up the development rights, then basically the person realizes the full economic value out of the land, but the land can be kept in agriculture. Now, that requires people in the city to understand the importance of maintaining this agricultural land and having it close in. Another thing that's been tried in a few places that I think has great potential, particularly when you're out into the area where it's now being subdivided, let's say into, oh, I don't know, 5-acre plots or 10-acre plots, what some people call, you know, the ranchettes, the places where somebody gets 5 acres and runs the lawnmower over it every week, but that's basically all that's being produced there is the grass for the lawn. But instead of having, for example, a 100-acre, let's say, piece of land or farm that you would divide into 20 of those building lots, just to make it simple to calculate, you could, in fact, strategically place 20 residences on that same land, you know, along the stream or in buffer areas or around the edges or whatever, and continue to farm maybe 80 or 90% of that land, which would be open space that would be held in common and managed in common by the 20 people that, say, lived in that community. Or if you wanted to go 500 acres, then you've got 100 families or so on. So you could, in essence, you could create a community in the kind of the urban fringe. And I think with places where you've had these kind of experiences, I think the indication is that you could basically realize the full economic value by having those, what, 20 residences on 100 acres where the 100 acres is held in common. You can create a small community of people, and every family living there, in essence, has the benefits of living on a farm. You could have space for gardens and animals and, you know, horses to ride or whatever. And then you could have one person or two people or two or three people or whatever that would be farming the 75, 80, 90 acres. You could have a small CSA there and maybe run a few small livestock operation, things of that nature. And that would be done by one or two or three people maybe that lived in the community and the rest of it. But the community as a whole would own the farming operation. Now, that would take a little creativity, but that wouldn't require all the public money then to buy the easement. As a consequence of developing the land that way, you could basically put it into an agricultural land use where it couldn't be developed and couldn't be sold off into the future. So I think that's one alternative. But even without those, I think we can do a lot just informally in terms of when you talk about having access to land, too often people think that they need access to a lot of land to farm. And as you know, you don't need access to a lot of land to start a farm. It may be that you only need 5 acres or 20 acres or 25 acres. I think the Growing for Market is a national newsletter that gets to what they call market gardeners that goes around the country. But what they indicated a few years back, they did a survey of all the readers of the Market Garden newsletter, and they determined that there were basically two different sizes of market gardeners. And there were those that would farm like 5 acres. And then in those situations, most of the labor would be done by the family that operated it. They would hire a few people during seasonal times. And depending, you know, on how intensely they did it and how many farmers markets they went to and whether they had a CSA or things of that nature. And then the next level up was like 25 acres. And at that level, then you're using a lot more mechanization and you're using more hired labor and things of that nature. But these aren't large amounts of land, even at the higher level. And when they ask them in terms of the net income, which would cover what the land and the labor and what the farmer put into the operation, then they would vary anywhere from about $10,000-$15,000 up to $50,000 or more. So with 25 acres, they were making a $50,000 return. So it doesn't take a whole lot of land. It just takes more understanding of how much land you need, and then some means to get a lender or someone who understands that there is potential in this kind of farming, and it doesn't require, you know, having 100 or 1,000 acres in order to make a living on a farm anymore.
Yeah, and we still have a lot of education to do, like I said, not just the city dwellers, but also the financial institutions
right.
that are willing to back that up and financially back up those enterprises. And then also some challenges we've had here in my county is with the tax appraisers not, you know, they're only used to seeing one type of agriculture, and that's if you don't cut hay or have cows out here, they don't think you deserve the ag exemption. And there was there was a, I don't know the whole details of it, but there was a piece of property here that was subdivided into 20-acre lots like you talked about.
Right.
And they were going in that direction where they still allowed the original owner, I guess, he still ran his cows and his and cut hay in this development, and those people had their nice homes and, you know, their yards fenced in, but
right.
they were basically in the middle of a ranch, and it
right.
looked great. And but the tax appraisers here took away their ag exemption, telling them they had to have each 20-acre lot individually fenced, and hay had to be cut individually on them, that they couldn't qualify as a group, you know. So, but that was the exact kind of thing that we're trying to encourage, how to manage land more responsibly and not for it to turn into a suburb out here in the country. You know?
Well, I think there has to be some means of transferring the development rights on that property. You know, if the people wanted to be there and have their 20 acres shared, then if they still wanted to leave open the opportunity at some time in the future, then they're going to subdivide that into much smaller lots. Then you can see the justification for saying you're going to have to pay the higher taxes, because it's really you're really just sitting here, you know, with a cheap base for speculating for land values in the future. But if on that operation you said, okay, we're going to have the ranch and we're going to have the residences here, and this is going to be a good place to live as well as continue to farm, and then you basically say this land is essentially fully developed. There'll be no more development in terms of residences on this piece of property. It'll be farmed from here, you know, to 99 years into the future. Then there wouldn't be any basis for raising the land values and calling it residential as opposed to agriculture, because it would be prohibited from being turned into residential at some time in the future. So I think, you know, the farmers are going to have to realize that if you're going to have the low tax base and that sort of thing, then there needs to be some transfer of development rights to preclude, you know, people just simply using that as a cheap way to speculate on land that's eventually going to be developed anyway, because the intent is to, you know, to keep this land in agriculture and keep it productive indefinitely. And if farmers are willing to go along with that and say, okay, well, I want this to be farmland, then they shouldn't be taxed at the higher rate.
So what point are you going to hit on here coming in Houston in a few weeks?
Well, I'm going to talk about what I think is the potential for local foods and the absolute necessity of kind of relocalizing the food system as we go into the future. I'm going to talk about some of the basic trends, which I think is important, that happened in the past. I think you mentioned previously that it only took us like 50 years to develop this industrial agriculture and an industrial food system, and I think that's important for people to recognize, and so we could see just as big a changes in the 50 years ahead. You know, I can remember, you know, I'm 68 years old, but I can remember when I was probably 10 or 12 years old in the southern part of Missouri where I grew up, the first supermarket that came into our part of the country. It was a Piggly Wiggly store. Mm-hmm. And up until then, you would take your grocery list to the local grocery store, and they would have everything behind the counter, and you'd give it to a clerk, and they would go back and fill up a bag with the various things you had on your list, you know, 5 pounds of beans and 2 pounds of bacon and you know, a box of can of bacon powders or whatever was on that list, they would get it from behind there. So up until then, you know, that's kind of the way things work. Then within, that would have been in the late 40s or early 50s, but then by the late 50s, early 60s, supermarkets were everywhere. And that was basically the way people were buying their food, was in the retail grocery stores, with, you know, the big supermarkets. You'd go in and push your cart around and pick up everything. You had a meat department and milk department and bread and groceries and so on. And now where we are today, you know, the giant super centers and all that has occurred, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years. So all of that transformation took place within a period of about 40 or 50 years in here. The important thing, I think, for also people to remember is that the first supermarket was not invented in the 40s. Actually, the first Piggly Wiggly store was the first store in the country, and it was established in Memphis, Tennessee. I happened to be down there and saw the historic plaque in Memphis, and it was established in the year of 1916 during First World War. So it was really from about 1916 to probably 30 years later before supermarkets really began to catch on and really began to go. So people have a tendency now to look at the trend that's going on in organic foods and the trend that's going on right now in local foods. We've had the organic food movement now for the last 15, almost 20 years now, growing at a rate of close to 20% per year. It's leveled off a little bit, but it's still growing 15, 17% per year. And we have the local food movement, which is now, I call it the most dynamic, if not the fastest growing segment. But organic food still accounts for about less than, a little bit less than 4% of the food in the grocery store. And then if you count all the natural and various other things that have some sort of label, grass-based things like that, we're probably talking about 6 or 7%. And people look at that and say, well, it's so insignificant. You know, it's been growing out here for 15, 20 years, but they say it's still very small. And my reminder is that's basically what went on with supermarkets for 15, 20, 25 years. But within the next 15, 20 years, the whole system changed, just as if it were changing overnight. And I think that's what we're seeing now. The demand today, I'm convinced that from a whole range of different studies, that there's at least a quarter and probably a third of the people today are looking for something fundamentally different than what they're finding in the supermarkets or in the fast food restaurants and so on. And the organic movement and the natural food movement and the grass-based and the hormone and antibiotic-free that we talk about, and humanely ranged and cage-free and free-range, and all of those are people expressing dissatisfaction, basically a rejection of this industrial food system for a host of reasons, which I will talk about. But it has to do with food quality, it has to do with food safety, food security, concerns about now, about issues of global warming, fossil energy use. And one I'm going to hit on is kind of growing social inequity, which is a consequence of this industrialization. And all of these things are driving creating a whole new food system out here. And I'd say a quarter to a third of the people are already looking for something that's fundamentally different, and we're only supplying, you know, maybe a fifth of that is being supplied today. The biggest obstacle that you hear people talk about particularly in the organic food business state, where it's growing so fast, including in the mainstream supermarkets. A few weeks ago, I was out at Organic Summit, I guess it was, in Boulder, Colorado, and these were mainly people there from the retail food sector, from the mainstream food sector, talking about organics, and the biggest challenge they have is finding enough growers who will grow it. And I think one of the biggest obstacles is this traditional kind of industrial agriculture mindset in USDA and the agricultural colleges and what I call the agricultural establishment, all the commodity organizations and things of that nature. They're telling farmers out here and ranchers that the future is in this high-tech, biotech, continued industrialization of agriculture. And so they're reluctant then, the people out here that have been farming and own and controlled a lot of the land, they're reluctant to make the switch because the people that they've been led to respect are telling them, just continue doing what you've been doing, even though it's not working and even though a growing segment of the food system wants something fundamentally different. So I think, you know, it'd be relatively easy to have a change in attitude, and then it's going to take some time for farmers to learn how to farm. You being a farmer, you know that, you know, as Wendell Berry says, it takes 5 years to learn your farm, not to learn how to farm in general, but to understand your particular farm and how to work with it to be productive. So it'll take some time for the transition, but I think in, you know, 15, 20 years that we could have a fundamentally different food system and a fundamentally different kind of agriculture, and that's what I hope to tell the folks when I'm down in Houston, is that these changes are taking place. The change may seem painfully slow for people that have been involved in the system and are trying to figure out, well, how are we going to produce enough food locally or how are we going to produce enough food organically? It may seem slow, but I think that's the basic nature of change. And when you get to what some people refer to as a tipping point, when you get to a certain level, then the pieces begin to fall in place, and the next thing you know, you're living in a new food world, so to speak.
Well, I appreciate you getting the word out, and I know you've been involved in it a long time, and I'm just honored as a farmer, a new farmer, to be a part of the solution. It's encouraging. you know, our work is a lot more rewarding than when we know who's eating our food, and it is tough work. And I think, you know, a lot more farmers, when they do, besides the increase of profit margin per acre, your whole life is so much more rewarding when you when you're not just, I mean, when you could almost care less who you're feeding because it's something shipped 1,500 miles, you know. And it is, there's a shift happening, and it's basically because of consumer demand and awareness, and you know, that's the one thing that we've noticed with our customers. You know, it's not race, it's not religion, it's not income bracket. Really, the only thing that we found, two things that we found that our customers have in common, is one of them is they know what real food is. They're hungry for real food. Mm-hmm. And the second one is they're finding this on the internet. You know, the internet has just empowered people to find their farmers and for farmers to be able to get the word out and connect with their communities. And that's why I think the next generation of young farmers have that computer savvy where they can now, you know, half of what we do as a local farm is producing food, but the other half is marketing and distributing, and it's management intensive again on the sales level. And like I said, a lot of farmers stuck in the other paradigm, you know, they don't even mess with selling their crop. It's, you know, and it's there's a shift happening, and I'm encouraged by it, and I'm looking forward to seeing you down here in Houston. I'm going to be there,
Well, I think while you're on the subject here, I think the new technology you're talking about, information technologies, create great possibilities to create. I think it'll be an important part of the new food system. If people, you know, again say, well, what kind of food system could you possibly have that would be local, that would serve everybody? I think if you look down the road a ways and higher energy prices and that sort of thing, I could envision the time whenever you'd have local farmers that would have the customer contacts and would have people that know them and things of that nature, but on a routine basis, then they would make their food available for what they'd have available, you know, each day or each week for delivery would be made available on the internet. And there's people that are already doing that. And then the people that want to buy products from your farm would simply go on the internet, and they would have a standing order, or they might have shares or whatever in addition to you know, the normal kind of CSA sort of thing, but they could be able to add to that, and that information then from your farm and their orders would go to a kind of a central point where you would get an indication as to go to this kind of collection point, that you would get an indication as to how much of each product that you need to take to that point, you know, like each morning or tomorrow or 3 days a week or however often you want to take it there for your customers. And from that point, it would be put onto trucks like, you know, the FedEx or UPS or various other ones. I live in a community out here. We have about 30 people, but there's probably at least two or three FedEx or UPS or DHL or whatever trucks come through this neighborhood every week. There's no reason that those trucks couldn't be, you know, have a cooler or refrigerated box on the back of it and stop by some distribution point and pick up food for everybody in this community every day. And so every one of us wouldn't be driving to the grocery store every day, and every one of us, you know, wouldn't necessarily be driving, you know, to our CSA point every day. We'd still have the contact through the internet. You would have days on your farms when people would come out, you know, because they'd want to see what was going on, and you could have a way of maintaining this personal connectedness with your customers, but that the food would move very efficiently through a local community from local farmers to local customers. That would go through kind of a central distribution point, not everybody for the whole community. You could have a dozen of those within a community if you wanted to, because we have, you know, and that would be a much more efficient system then of delivering food from an energy standpoint, from a greenhouse gases standpoint, and from a convenience standpoint, and then also would be a way of maintaining a personal contact between local farmers and local people within the community, but getting that food out there every day in a very efficient way.
Well, that's the exact vision that we've got here. I'm so happy that you brought that up, because that's what we're trying to do here in Houston, and in a lot of ways it's we can't be dependent on even one farm like that. You know, we're networking with other farmers, and we all have different things to offer,
right.
And if I got my trucks already going into Houston, I'm happy to pick up stuff from other farmers and take it in with the orders, and for us to all network and work together. It's really exciting. We're seeing it happen. We're going to make it happen here in Houston. And
right. And there's no reason it can't happen. I'm just saying now what we're doing is these trucks coming through the community is more efficient than anything else, and you're ordering more and more stuff over the Internet. Most of the stuff that's on these trucks has been ordered over the Internet.
Right.
But it could be even more efficient if these trucks were also delivering our food, and we get to know our food truck driver and as well as our farmers, and all of that's done locally. You know, it's not bringing in product from all over the world. It's bringing product from local farmers, and it's taken back out to local customers. And it can be done very efficiently with the systems that we have in place today, even more efficiently from an energy standpoint and from greenhouse gases standpoint, and from the standpoint of building communities than we're doing it today, because basically those jobs would be here locally. Then things that can't be produced in the community, you could have some means then of ensuring what I call the ecological and social integrity, kind of a domestic fair trade process, that you could also bring in certain things from outside that would make those available, but only if it didn't compete with the local farmers.
So there might be a day in the future where we see the return of the milkman and
right.
And truck farms again.
It's
everything that we reminisce
right.
about.
And the Walmart stores would be closed up, or maybe something that you'd go to once a month or something. But I mean, my point is I'm old enough, I've seen all this other stuff develop in my lifetime. I'm saying within the next 50 years it could be just as different, and it could be a whole lot better.
Well, I appreciate your time with us here today.
And I appreciate the opportunity, and I look forward to visiting with you when I make it to Houston.
All right. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Folks, I hope you enjoyed that interview we have with Mr. John Eichert. Again, small farms are real farms. That's encouraging. What did you get out of it?
I think he brought up some really great points, encouraging us that this is something, the paradigm can shift, that we had 50 years of a change in a direction we're not so pleased with, and that we could easily see it change again, and we're not stuck.
Yeah, we're not stuck. There's hope, and future food will be more local. I hope everyone can make it out to the food and sustainable prosperity for the Houston region. That's a tongue twister. It's a conference happening down in Houston today. Happening September 4th. It's all day long and includes lunch. You can get information about the conference at thehoustonfood.net. And thanks again for joining us here at Home Sweet Farm Radio. We look forward to talking to you again, and hopefully I'll be throwing some seeds in the ground.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Goodbye.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one, and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, where they were put in boxes and they came out all the same. And there's doctors and lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.